making Japanese, and she's watching DVDs in Oakland, in Oakland. Now I'm driving up the 5, and she waits so I arrive in Oakland, in Oakland.
Everything that I wanted, only gotta drive for the moment. If you tell me turn around, then I'm on it for the moment. But you know me, you know how I get when I'm lonely. I think about you in the moments, but everything you do is so Oakland, so Oakland. Foot on the gas, I'm just trying to pass all the red lights and the stop signs. I'm ready to go before I get to the baby, that's a problem. Cause I'm way too scared to call and you might give me a stay night.
Oh,
welcome to the Eastern Shore. I'm Brock Winstead. Today on the show, the story of a boy and his hashtag. But first, let's talk about reading. My primary reading technology these days isn't paper. It's my smartphone. That's been the case for several years now, more or less as long as I've had a smartphone. For some of that time, I have had or had access to a tablet. My wife has a Kindle that I could use if I wanted to. And of course, some number of printed books and magazines still manage to find their way into our house. I don't know how that happens. I don't know how they're getting past the guards, but here they are. But still, most of the text I take in these days, I get from the little rectangular piece of glass that I keep in my pocket all the time. That last part, the in my pocket all the time part, that's why I do most of my reading on my phone. It's there in the dead times, like when I'm standing in line at the grocery store or on BART. It's always there, waiting for me to touch it and make it do things for me. It can do things like show me the latest 140 character inanities on Twitter and tell me how my own most recent 140 character inanity was received. Or it can remind me that people on Facebook love their children, in case I had forgotten. Or it can give me access to some of the best writing in the world if I take a little time to find it. And I try to remind myself that this is something that my pocket computer can do that is probably more useful than looking at still more instantaneous grams. One of the places that I find some of the best writing in the world online is a website called Long Reads, which is more or less exactly what it says on the tin. Long Reads selects and promotes, curates, if you will, long, meaning anything over 1,500 words, long articles and essays and stories of all kinds from around the web. It helps make sense of the sometimes overwhelming ocean of writing and other content that lives online. The Long Reads editorial promise is, we will find for you beautifully written, deeply reported, and otherwise powerful stories from authors writing all over the world about all kinds of topics. Check these out. Come back in a few days. We'll have more. Long Reads also, I think, helps foster a culture of longer attention spans, which is kind of the opposite of what everything else online does. I don't remember when I found Long Reads or where I found it, but since I did, it has pointed me to some of my favorite pieces of writing ever in any form. And I'm glad it's there, not just for me as a reader, but for the writers whose work it highlights. Because, as my friend Jim O'Brien reminded me recently, happiness is being read. This wonderful resource for focusing attention on the best long-form storytelling on the web started, somewhat ironically, as a hashtag, as a way of marking tweets recommending good, long writing. That hashtag became a Twitter account of its own, then an accompanying website, then a company around that website. Then, just about a year ago, Longreads was acquired by Automattic. That's AutoMattic. Automattic is the parent company of WordPress, the widely used blogging content management system. You know the saying, a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a hashtag. The creator of that Longreads hashtag, and the Twitter account, and the website, and the company, the person who has gone on this journey of 1,000 miles, is my guest for this show, Mark Armstrong. Mark and I sat down last week at the Automattic offices to talk about why he started Longreads, what he did with it in its first 5 years from hashtag to acquisition, what he and Longreads have been up to in the years since that acquisition, and where and how Longreads fits in the attention economy that we've built around the web today. Mark was born in the Central Valley and lives in Oakland now. I was happy to have that excuse to talk with him about Longreads, which we did at length. And here's that talk now. Actually, closer is better if you're okay leaning, but it'll pick you up either way.
Okay.
So, Mark Armstrong, hello.
Hi.
Thank you for doing this, for sitting down and talking with me.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
This may be an oversimplification, but did you really turn a hashtag into a job?
I think that's actually fairly well simplified, though there are many, many better ways to get jobs than to start a hashtag. And
I wish you would tell me some of them.
Applying to jobs. The basic thing with Longreads, I started it as a hashtag in 2009. So we're coming up on 6 years ago that I started this. And
so why did you start this hashtag?
Well, I came into this world as a reader first. My background is in journalism. I started out my career as a newspaper reporter. I worked briefly for the LA Times, number of local papers down in Southern California, and then had been in New York working in magazines and digital publishing for several years. But Longreads specifically, I was coming at, you know, from a reader perspective. I was commuting from Brooklyn to Manhattan and just got my iPhone, just discovered the Instapaper app for saving articles offline on your phone, and that's the moment you're sitting there on the train, and this is still new to everybody in 2009, that you're sitting there on the train and you're looking for something quite a bit different than what you were looking for maybe when you're browsing the web at work. And so that was where, from my perspective, I wanted the narratives, I wanted the magazine features to save on my phone. And at the time, there was no real centralized place for finding and sharing these kinds of stories. So this is in 2008, I started playing with the word Longreads. And then I bought the domain, which is the next, you know, the next move. And then I just, it was freely available. No one had owned it previously. Yeah, no one had wanted it previously.
That made it real. Spending whatever, $12 made it real.
Once you've paid that money, yeah. But then it becomes sort of this list of domains, that ideas that you either execute or you never execute.
Right.
And so I sat on it for 6 months. And I also had in my head, I had a blog back in 2002 that I had started.
Didn't we all?
Exactly. And it was this thing where it was called FresYes.com. It was actually a pop cultural tribute to my hometown of Fresno.
All right.
And, you know, I had these moments where I'd post a lot in a week and I'd build up this momentum and get some attention and excitement for what I was writing and feel really good about it. And then I just let it sit there for 3 weeks. Yeah. And then I thought to myself, okay, if I ever get into this, even, you know, some similar side project in the future, I'd just be consistent about it. So when it came to Longreads, I thought the same thing, which was, okay, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it and I'm going to go all in. But I sat on the domain, and then at the same time I was playing with Twitter and trying to think of what to do with Twitter. And then I just threw it out there as a hashtag one day. Hey, everybody, let's find and share our favorite stories. And, you know, share it using the hashtag, and then through the Long Reads Twitter account, we'll go through and pick some of our favorites. Mm-hmm. And Instapaper, I call that Instapaper, they immediately responded, I love this idea, and others chimed in. There were writers from the New York Times that immediately started chiming in. And I could tell right away that there was some, that I wasn't alone in this desire for building a place for people to find this stuff. There was, yeah. there was a hunger for it that hadn't been served yet. And so so from there, I really, you know, wanted to keep building from it. So it was a formula that pretty much is the same to this day, which is people share on the hashtag, and a quote unquote long read is any story over 1500 words. So that could be nonfiction or fiction. And then we would go through from the main account and then sort of pick and choose some of the favorites. So it was just me at the time, and I would just go through and pick one or two stories that I liked and put them on the Twitter account.
So it was a really kind of, I don't mean this in a negative way, it was a really kind of haphazard editorial process at first. Just whatever came in, you were trying to sort through it, make sense of it, and send out the stuff that you liked.
Exactly.
Was there an editorial voice that you were shooting for, or was it just, I like this stuff?
I think from the very beginning, it was definitely personal taste driven. So, and I think that that was one of the things that sort of led it to move more heavily into nonfiction than fiction. I was reading nonfiction and magazine journalism more than I was reading short stories. Yeah. And Twitter has always been more of a news-driven or nonfiction-driven community as well. But beyond that, you know, the secondary piece was that I wanted to take the curation seriously, which is one, it would be pieces that I personally read top to bottom and recommended and could stand by. And two, wanted to have a diverse mix of authors and sources. So both large national magazines and recognizable authors and small publications that you wouldn't discover otherwise. And that was kind of an important mix in the curation.
You know, you started this thing as essentially a call on Twitter. Just send me your long reads. Twitter is kind of the epitome of the short attention span economy that we have developed around the internet. But you were using it to draw attention to the opposite of that, to long work that required, deserved, sustained attention and consideration.
Yeah, Twitter is interesting because it really, I mean, it is so complementary to what, I mean, Long Reads existed because it's because of Twitter. It was the ability for a community to get together very quickly and through a hashtag to share stories and do them and feature them quickly, and that stream. when I started in 2009, it was really, that was the biggest lesson early on, was what a great curation tool it was for getting a community involved and sharing something and coming up with a specific service and curating something that had not already been curated. And I think that's something where it hadn't really, Twitter has gotten noisier over the years. And I think, these kinds of and I think the hashtag has become more meme driven or joke driven over the years versus like, oh, this is something that's actually useful and will continue and something that you can and look to. Yeah. So I think there's still a lot of opportunity in terms of finding these niches and these ways to curate and organize community that still haven't come out yet. And I think there's still a lot of opportunity for people to play with that. I think the question is whether that's on Twitter or whether that's on one of these newer channels, like what, you know, what the next version of that looks like is really, really what I'm curious about right now.
It was a hashtag on Twitter. You also went and grabbed the domain mm-hmm. early in the process of creating this thing. You didn't know what it was going to be, mm-hmm. but you thought, sure, let's snag it just in case. But it was really just you working out kind of a hobby of starting, like you said, as a reader, trying to find stuff that you liked and could fill that commute time and that other people might like and sharing it with them. What was the next level and how did you know it was time to go there?
Well, you know, the thing is that It existed just as the Twitter account for the first year, and it existed just as myself doing this and running the Twitter account for the first year. And it had built up enough attention behind the scenes. This is kind of an interesting thing about the Twitter hashtag and community that builds up around it. It feels natural, and it feels like something that builds on itself, in which in some cases it does. But there was also a lot of legwork I was doing behind the scenes to go try and build up publisher buy-in as well, to go to the New Yorker, go to the Atlantic, go to the editors there, and get them to use it. And I was interested in this idea of creating a new subcategory of article. The word article, or the definition of article on the web, is basically means anything with a permalink. Right. And so I wanted to define a very specific subcategory of article that was dedicated to people who love to read and get buy-in on this shared taxonomy and get people to buy into it, not just on Twitter, but across, you know, any other platform as well. So I'm going behind the scenes, and I'm, you know, going to talk to ProPublica or going and emailing friends at The All, mm-hmm. and telling them to share their essays, share their long-form journalism. And then the next step was, once I saw that buy-in, once I saw people getting on board, once I saw others start to sort of see what we were doing and build off it as well, I knew that I wanted to turn it into an actual company and get some other people involved, build out a site, and really do more, you know, within this community that had developed.
When was that, give or take?
So the site, longreads.com, launched in 2010. Before that, of course, there were I roped in three friends of mine who had, you know, I think everybody who got involved, one I had worked with previously. There's Mike Dang, who was the managing editor, who became the managing editor and is now still with us as well. Kel, who's Kel Reistad, who is a designer I'd worked with in the past, and Hakan Bakalbasi, who's a developer we worked with in the past. So the four of us built the site out and then turned it into an actual company. And I think that was then taking what we'd learned and applying it to just building a basic site. And each step of the way, and then over time, we added a paid membership. We started to host our own content.
When did the paid memberships come along?
So we started paid memberships, I believe, in 2011.
So it had been around for a couple, maybe not two full years at this mm-hmm. point. It was a functioning website of its own. You had built a team mm-hmm. to manage this thing. Why memberships?
The thing that I thought was most interesting about the business models for digital media was, in terms of this kind of storytelling, it requires big risks, big financial risks when you're going and assigning and commissioning a story. And so I had become interested in the idea of doing some sort of recurring subscription in which readers are helping to finance this. Essentially, what at the beginning for us, it was simply they were financing what was largely curation and this small team to run the service mm-hmm. itself.
And keeping the lights on.
Exactly. So they could pay $3 a month or $30 a year, mainly to support the service. There were a few other perks along the way, whether it's a mug or a tote bag.
Was there pricing science behind those numbers?
No. It felt like a small enough amount, especially when we were primarily curating. And I think we wanted to do something and we've played with this number along the way since then. And we have found that people did want to give more. So giving them the option to give more was something we wanted to work on as well. But the mere fact of having a recurring subscription is a reader's buy-in that they want you to exist next month, not just once this month. And so I thought that was compelling. And I thought as we had, you know, visions of eventually funding work, and I think we've always wanted to do as much as we can to help keep the community thriving, whether that's helping publishers, helping writers, or helping readers, that we wanted to, okay, if we get beyond this point in which we're supporting ourselves, let's, you know, bring in this money to help fund writers or publishers in some way as well to keep this stuff going. Because a natural ad-driven model, we've seen what kind of happens with that, and it doesn't always lend itself to, hey, let's do these big giant pieces.
You said when not long after you started, you were making the rounds to publishers and editors. What was the pitch to those publishers and editors that you were trying to get buy-in?
Well, the thing was, they ended up in some cases they also ended up reaching out to me because the idea of long reads and the hashtag long reads and the community within it was solving a very specific problem that they were all encountering themselves, which is these magazines had built out their own websites and had been building out their digital teams. So the feature writers on staff were now in a position where their features were going up online, but the blogs and whatever material, they're getting into a daily flow at, you know, New York Magazine's website or some of these others, that the features would quickly fall off the homepage. And these features have a different metabolism and they have a different lifespan than normal kind of, you know, moment-to-moment breaking news content or you know, some of the disposable pieces about whatever is happening during a given day. These are stories that will live a very long life. They'll continue to be popular for weeks and months and years after they've been first published. And we've seen that definitely as we've looked at our own kind of performance of stories over the past 6 years, is that a story can have multiple lives and do really well. So for them, it was a very easy thing. This is something that had been their features had been under promoted and underappreciated. So having new venues for them to promote their work was beneficial to everybody. So a lot of them, it took very little work to get them involved.
And you started, you knew fairly early on that you wanted to move toward commissioning your own work.
In various forms or another. We wanted to fund work. And a lot of what we're doing now is a manifestation of all of that. So when we're funding work now, we're funding both purely original work with writers who we've followed over the years, but we're also funding original work in partnership with other publishers too. And I think this is kind of an interesting point now, which is how big will the pool grow of publishers who are producing these kinds of stories that take a lot of work and a lot of money to do, and how much farther can we expand this in order to really grow and support a larger number of writers and a more diverse pool of writers who are doing this kind of in-depth work? Can we get 30, 40, 50 more publishers who are paying competitive rates to pay writers to do this work?
With long reads helping to essentially supplement that.
Yeah, wherever we can, wherever we see opportunities to do that, can we help fund that? And can the members help fund that?
So I like it as a reader, but I am not in the habit of acquiring companies. So what made long reads attractive to Automatic, in whose conference room we are currently sitting?
So to back up a little, probably 2010, I get a random email from Matt Mullenweg, who is the founder of WordPress, and he sent me an email. He had been following long reads.
This is very early in the life of long reads.
Yeah, it was. I don't even know if the site had existed yet, but he had followed it. So we went to coffee in New York and basically just stayed in touch over the years. And the environment, we had been running it for 4.5 years on nights and weekends, essentially. We all had other jobs. And so we hit a point where for us to step on the gas, we wanted to, we wanted to find a partner who would help us, find a good home for it, find a place that kind of fit within our principles and mission and where we could help each other. And I think, at the same time, there was a lot of attention and a lot of money pouring into a lot of startups that were doing this long-form narrative work. And so we're seeing a lot more stories that are digital first. I look at the first couple years of long reads, and I did some analysis of what was being shared on the hashtag, and 63% of the stories shared within the hashtag were stories that I'd identified as pieces that had been assigned by a print magazine and had just happened to migrate online. So this concept of a digital long form renaissance, I found a little bit flawed because these were stories that were being funded by print money. So to pretend that this is, you know, the internet is great and has solved all of our problems was, well, that's great. It just happened to work out, though, that the magazines didn't mind putting them online for free. So fast forward to, you know, probably 2 years ago, and a lot more startups getting into the game, and which is a great thing for writers and paying professional writers real money to do this work. And I think from our perspective, we wanted to be in a position where we could kind of make good on what long reads could be and what we wanted to do in terms of helping push things farther ahead with this idea of not quite democratized storytelling, but funding the community in a much more effective way versus just keeping the lights on. And so, you know, we started talking to Matt, and, you know, the thing with WordPress and what he created and what Automattic was about made a ton of sense. So for some reason, for various reasons, the fit worked out really nicely. And what happened was, you know, there were a number of others who contributed, but the core four-person team of Longreads ended up coming on full-time to join Automattic's or WordPress.com's editorial team. And so the editorial team within WordPress.com was relatively new. So we've come in to work on initiatives within WordPress.com that kind of fit with similar ideas around curation, talent development, and then also push long reads ahead as well and work with storytellers through that channel too.
When was that formalized?
So that was a year ago exactly, April 2014, we were acquired by Automattic.
Mm-hmm. Long Reads continues to exist as an independent, you know, brand, essentially. But how has your work changed?
Well, we wanted to do a couple things post-acquisition. One was we had thought about what happens with the membership, because this started as a membership that was essentially supporting the service to keep it alive. Now being part of this larger company, that wasn't as necessary. But we also felt very strongly, and I think everybody agreed across the board within all of our team, that the membership could still be very beneficial to producing more work that feeds into the community. So our idea was to turn it into a giant digital story fund. So we announced that in the middle of last year, and then WordPress.com is matching all of the members' contributions. So we've got this story fund that we're then going in, assigning original work, and we're going to publishers that we've worked with in the past and featuring exclusives from them, or going in together on assignments. We're experimenting with a lot of different models and a lot of different arrangements, and we're still in that experimentation phase. But we're about 6 months into doing our originals and have been really happy with the results so far and worked with a lot of writers that we really respect.
In addition, you are still doing the curatorial side. Has that changed? Is the pace picked up, or is it still kind of, is the pace determined by what you think people can get through in a week?
That's a tricky one, because you definitely do not want to overwhelm people. And I think we created all of these sort of different worlds that would fit a lot of different people's reading appetites. So Twitter, if the original idea was the hashtag is kind of the fast lane for the power reader who's got nothing but time and just wants the raw feed. Just give me stories. I want more. So that was kind of this open raw feed where the voracious reader can go for it. Then you had the Twitter account itself, which was anywhere from 2 to 5 picks in a given day. And I think the expectation was never that, you know, you were going to read all of them or that anyone should be expected to read all of them. But it's enough that, you know, there's some movement and people have a little bit of choice and they can see what's going on. And frankly, it's all moving at the pace of what we can feel good recommending.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, some days there's very little that we're posting. Some days there's a lot that we're posting. So for us, it's a matter of just still being as critical as possible in terms of what we're recommending. And it's always been about the mix as well, which is that's great. We can throw in some New Yorker, but we should also have these smaller publications featured, because these are the publishers who, you know, you might not run across all the time. Regional publications, yeah. Like This Land Press in Oklahoma, which we did an event with them in New York, actually, last October. But regional magazines, literary journals, so many great small publishers right now.
For whom it is somewhat larger risk to do longer storytelling, because they don't have the built-in audience of, say, a New Yorker.
Exactly. A lot of them may be nonprofits, or a lot of them are bootstrapped or very small operations.
It's not an expectation that everyone can or will read everything that Longreads promotes and or produces in a given week or month. I know some people who are extraordinarily voracious and fast readers, but aside from a few outliers, I sometimes look at something like Longreads and I think, who has time to read all this? You were reading, and I'm sure still are, quite a bit in those early days yourself, just mm-hmm. to kind of make sense of what people were sending to you and try to figure out what to recommend. How many words a day would you say you read?
That's a tough one. I would say I probably go through... So to break down who's doing what right now, there are probably still... Let's see... aside from a few outside contributors, there's still three main editors who are doing the editor's picks within Longreads. It's myself, Mike Dang, and Julia Wick. And then we have contributions from the editorial team within WordPress.com who are contributing, and also contributors who are working with us as we go and feature. We're featuring a lot more book excerpts and that kind of thing. So we have a growing pool of contributors that are helping find and share some of these stories. And I think it really depends on the day for me, depending on also whether I'm reading for curation or whether I'm reading submissions, original submissions or pitches. There's a lot of reading.
Sure. you and the Longreads team now here at Automatic have created a model that, for now at least, that pays for original long-form writing, trying to add to the pool of good stuff in the world. You are operating in kind of specific niche, but within this world of journalism and writing on the web where we give stuff away for free.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think right now are the models of paying for good work on the web, or good work that winds up on the web, that are working and might be sustainable?
This has changed a ton over the past 6 years as well. There was sort of a period in which a lot of people were putting ebooks forward as, you know, the great hope for funding this work, and then paywalls as well. So when we started the Longreads membership, it was pure donation. A year later, we introduced exclusives or member exclusives. When they started, they were ebooks or essentially paywalled stories that were available only for members. We essentially lifted that paywall because we found that the vast majority of the people who were subscribing to support Longreads were doing it because they wanted to support Longreads, not because they wanted access to a specific story.
They weren't buying a product. They were supporting organizations.
Exactly. They wanted to be, they liked what the service we were providing and wanted to support it. And that continues to this day. And those are the emails I get from members that they like what we send them, whether it's in our weekly email or whether it's through the Twitter feed or a Facebook page. However they interact with us, or just coming to longreads.com. So from our perspective, you know, we thought the paywall was frankly limiting, that a metered paywall might make sense if we played with that in the future. But frankly, it was more about just getting the stories out and letting people share them and letting people access them as easily as possible. So the New York Times has probably shown the most success in terms of what they've done with a metered paywall. But those were kind of the experiences we had encountered, at least playing with these models. And I feel like recurring subscription is valuable. I feel like advertising is we have a very small amount of advertising that runs on longreads.com, but not enough that it disrupts the experience. And that's beneficial. And there's never, you know, my experience has been been there's never any one clear answer or one specific answer. It has to depend on the community that you're serving, and it will end up being probably a mix of a lot of different things that help keep something running. And I just, you know, I just threw in for a Kickstarter for Emily Books, which is Emily Gould's book subscription project, and I'm sure they're using Kickstarter to fund, using subscription to fund. It's going to be a mix of a lot of things, and it's going to be about building community and finding something that people value along the way. It's never as clean as ads are the future or crowdfunding is the future. It hasn't been that clean.
You mentioned earlier that there are other people or other companies doing what Longreads is doing insofar as they're trying to draw attention to long written work online. Mm-hmm. Who else is doing similar work?
Well, you know, BuzzFeed had, you know, they developed an entire long form section, and Vox Media, which they've got a large pool of sites that are all doing features. Glenn Stout over at SB Nation, he's been doing it for several years now. And so Medium and Matter and a lot of others who are out there in this space who are funding this work. You know, I think I'm still interested in the independents and the smaller publications because of the simple diversity of what topics and what styles they're going to offer. I think, the New South is a small publisher we've worked with, and they've done some incredible work. Theirs have been primarily ebooks. Another is based here in San Francisco, Radio Silence from Dan Stone, which is kind of a music literary magazine, which has done some great work, and we've worked with them as well. And so I think, you know, there's kind of these larger entities, but there's just a huge amount of small independent magazines right now who are really doing great work. And I think it's so important we find ways to support them and help keeping them thriving.
Are there other people or organizations that try to do the same sort of curatorial look at this that Longreads does? Drawing from lots of different places?
Curation-wise, it really blew up after we launched. Well, the granddaddy of all was Arts and Letters Daily, which has been around forever. And I think if you're to look at the curatorial ancestor. And then you've got the browser, which launched in 2009 and continues to this day. I don't know if you ever checked that one out, Robert Cottrell. And a number of others who are playing with curation right now. The thing is that there's so much available right now, and it's so much driven by social media traffic on Twitter and Facebook that it's a really tricky thing to build a community around in some ways. And also, you know, it's more challenging than ever to try and find surprising new sources, you know, because there are a lot of people playing in that pool.
All of that kind of swirls around. You've been building Longreads on this idea that there is an appetite for good long-form writing, that the internet does not necessarily mean just tweets and listicles, but there is still only so much time in the day.
Mm-hmm.
There are only so many kind of reader minutes in the world. How do you think about capturing more of those reader minutes, since that's part of, I mean, the world that you're in?
Yeah, I think that's a tricky thing, which is more of those reader minutes is especially a tricky thing. And your reader minutes change depending on where you are in your life at any one moment. There may be periods in which you have time to read everything. There may be times you have time to read very little. And so I think for us, it has been, okay, let's figure out different ways that people can interact or get a taste of what's out there without making them feel guilty. So for me, it's not just, you know, people are going to have the time they have, but we do want to present to them a number of different ways that they can interact with our service without making them feel bad about themselves. So that, I
so
think...
Why aren't you reading more?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, I could badger people that you should be reading, you know, 5 stories a day, but I, you know, is that the best use of your time? I'm not sure what else you have going on at the moment. So I think it's less about increasing total reader minutes or some metric than it is, really adapting the service so it fits a lot of different reader interests. And it's not just minutes, it's also the types of stories they should be interacting with as well. In my view, we have a long way to go to sort of expanding our palette in terms of the types, the genres, and the different tastes. There's so many different types of readers and so many different great genres of storytelling out there that we've yet to really scrape the surface on. And I think that's where there's a lot of opportunity for us going forward as well, to really get to know all of the different styles and the diversity of tastes.
So speaking of diversity of taste, give me one of your recent favorite long reads. Give me a recommendation.
You know, I'm going local for you, because there's a few really great ones, and I'm not just going to even mention pure long reads originals. I'm going to mention locals, though. Yeah, exactly. So Collectors Weekly, I've been a fan of for a very long time, and they're based here in San Francisco. I love featuring their work because they go so deep into just a lot of very diverse topics. And there have been a few lately from them that I have loved. There was one recently about sort of a glimpse into the lives of Japanese prostitutes. Previously, they've done a series of pieces about the history of the car and essentially how roads became so pedestrian unfriendly and the laws that actually changed that. Another great San Francisco writer, Julia Shears, who did actually an adaptation of her book for long reads called Escape from Jonestown, which is a story about a teenager who escaped from the compound there during the massacre in the late 70s. So really a lot of interesting work coming out locally here that we've been able to feature.
You started this when you were in New York. You had been working in magazines, in publishing.
So I worked for Time Inc. for many years. Mm-hmm. And specifically, I was the digital news director for People Magazine's website. Okay. So this is an earlier life that I am sort of paying karmic retribution for. All my years sort of covering Britney Spears led to long reads. So the past decade for me had been working on the editorial side and working on digital strategy. And so when I started Long Reads, I had actually been at a personal finance startup. And those colleagues at the personal finance startup were those who joined me at Long Reads. It was a site called Bundle that was launched by Citibank and Microsoft. So and then over the years following, I had started working for a number of other startups as well and doing agency work. Worked for Pocket for several years, which is what brought me to San Francisco. And that sort of was another area of my interest in mobile reading, which is time shifting and save for later, which I thought was so critical to why people were jumping into this a little more than, say, 10 years ago. Yeah. You had social recommendation. You had the ability to time shift and save these stories. So all of these kind of factors, and of course tablets and smartphones, all of these factors coming together to a point where more people can dig into these stories because they're more accessible.
Do you miss reporting?
I do. I've thought about just my time in Palm Springs specifically. I was a reporter for a newspaper called the Desert Sun, which was a Gannett paper, and just such a gratifying experience to get to know a city in that way and to have license to go and be curious within a city and be a newcomer to it and have business owners or the mayor or city council members or community activist groups to you know, invite yourself or get invited to understand what's going on in a community like that. And I definitely miss that. And I have kept that interest in especially local journalism and local news and where that goes. And I think there's a lot of question about where local goes in the digital era. And a lot of great sites that, you know, Oakland Local, Oakland North, and that I now interact with and get to know what's going on around me when I'm a newcomer to town. I still definitely feel like a newcomer to the Bay Area.
Yeah, so you moved back to California in 2012. 12.
Yes.
And you're from California, but were you still new to the Bay Area, per se?
Yeah, new to the Bay Area. Had never lived in the Bay Area. My dad went to Berkeley High. My grandmother went to Piedmont High. So extended family in the East Bay. But this was our first time in the Bay Area. So it's been, you know, getting to know fairyland has really been...
You have a kid?
No, I just hang out
just like the,
at fairyland.
Yeah.
But yeah, and local papers, local blogs, these local newsletters, getting, you know, the Splashpad Park newsletter. These are the kinds of things that are keeping me up to date. And those are the kinds of things that, you know, they definitely are the moments when I feel like I miss reporting. So now I get to kind of do that vicariously through going and looking for writers who are doing interesting work, trying to come up with ways to, if not just featuring them and featuring their work on long reads, maybe figuring out ways to work with them on original stories or work with them and another publisher on original stories. So I really love, I love the process of just getting to know writers and editing and sort of packaging. That's always been an interest of mine as well.
So you're still applying the reporter's kind of professional nosiness,
yeah,
in an editorial stance now.
Exactly. And then within Automattic and within WordPress, this is also sort of a piece of it too, is that this is, WordPress is so enormous in terms of the number of people who use it. It's, you know, the fun fact is that, you know, the combination of WordPress.com and the open source WordPress, it's you know, powering something like 23% of the top million sites on the internet. And these are all independents as well, and or amateurs who are doing this work. So there's I think, a lot of interesting challenges for us to take some of the curation and some of the talent sort of discovery things that we've learned from long reads and apply it to broader kind of the broader blogging platform within WordPress as well. So we're kind of working on that as well, in addition to Long Reads.
How many members does Long Reads have?
Our membership right now is around 2,500. And that has stayed very steady over the past year. I think there's a lot more that we want to do with the membership over the year, the years to come as well. But, you know, with that support, and the thing is, it ends up being a mix of those who are monthly subscribers, those are yearly subscribers, and then also a mix of incoming flat donations as well. And I think that's something we're going to be experimenting more with in the months to come.
What do you think is next for Long Reads in its current incarnation?
Well, for us, it had been initially, once we introduced the idea of turning the Long Reads membership into a story fund, it was kind of getting the wheels in motion, getting assignments out, and starting to work on different models to fund work. So we're now 6 months into that, and we're now at a really good pace in which we're publishing a couple pieces a week, some of which are partnered, some of which are excerpts or exclusives, and then some of which are originals that we've assigned. So we're hitting the pace that we wanted to hit, especially keeping in mind that we wanted, when we sort of put together the idea of what an editorial calendar would look like for originals, we didn't want to come at this to where we're producing so much we cannot give them the time and the space that they deserve. So I think for us, it was about, you can't get on a treadmill and just throw things at a wall, especially with these pieces. They require both a ton of work on the front end and a ton of work on the back end to do outreach for those stories. And not just when they come out, but weeks and months beyond that, because that's what we're seeing with these pieces. They might hit, you know, we release something in November, it might hit in November and do well in November, but they're bubbling up again in January or in February in these just different contexts. Mm-hmm. So this is an argument to publishers as well, which is that, you know, it may feel like a big risk to commission a bigger piece and to spend the extra money on a bigger piece than, say, just, you know, firing short blog posts. But the payoff is so much bigger in terms of how, over the course of a year, it builds audience. and multiple times. So this is that's something I think we've learned a lot about just playing with these stories, is that there is a real traffic argument. If you are purely focused on traffic and you're a publisher, there is a real traffic argument to doing these larger pieces. They're not disposable. They are these wonderful narratives, and they live a long time. Following up on that, we're starting to do a lot more events. So we did an event in New York with the Slam Press. We just did an event in Portland with a number of great writers, Nathaniel Friedman and Nancy Rommelman, Megan O'Connell, who wrote one of our Long Reads exclusives about giving birth, which actually ended up being our most popular story ever, and Aaron Scott from Oregon Public Broadcasting. So, and that was a lot of fun, and these were, you know, them getting up and members of the community coming and them telling short stories based on some of their original pieces.
So Long Reads is about 6 years old as an entity. Mm-hmm. You turned a hashtag into a job and into a company. Company was acquired a year ago. You have moved into this new phase since that acquisition of helping pay for new work. And you seem to find that very gratifying, and I'm not assuming that you are looking for an exit anytime soon, but at some point the work of Long Reads might end, or you give it to someone else. What's next for you?
You know, I think the thing that has always interested me has been not just building an idea into a business and a community, a global community, seeing the number of different languages that are being shared across Long Reads has been really incredible. And so along the way, it's been an education for me. I didn't start out as, you know, I came into this just as a casual reader, and I have learned so much about the world of narrative journalism, about who's doing what work, about publishers that I may have never experienced, and getting introduced to all of them, meeting them in real life, and seeing this community grow over the past several years. I think for me, anything that I'm working on is going to be around the relationships I've built and finding out ways that I can be helpful to both storytellers, to other publishers within this world, and building new experiences that communities can get involved with. So that's really not a very good answer for you. But I think there's, you know, you start to get to know all of these writers and publishers and storytellers, and you realize that there's a lot that is still out there and not told yet, and also that there are just so many different ways to still experiment with storytelling. And I think, you know, this is interesting to me in terms of what you're going to do with your podcast next as well, because, you know, podcasting is the next big explosion. So where does podcasting go from here? But I think along the way, during these experiences, you know, when you're doing interviews, or if we were curating stuff, having a chance to interact with people who are doing that work is just expanding my mind in terms of, you know, where things can go next. And I can't imagine anything I do within Long Reads, within WordPress, will probably veer very far from what's happening now, which is finding good stories, exposing voices that have not been exposed on the internet, and finding new ways to do that.
Mark Armstrong, we have come to the end of our time together. Thank you very much for talking with me.
Brock, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And that was my talk with Mark Armstrong. He is the founder of Long Reads, a global community for finding and sharing outstanding stories. Since its acquisition last year by Automattic, the parent company of WordPress, as you heard Mark say, Long Reads has been commissioning new long-form writing, in addition to sharing work published elsewhere, as it has done from the start. You can check out what they're doing at longreads.com and on Twitter at longreads. If you've had your fill of reading, though, remember that you can listen to more conversations like this one at tespodcast.com. Subscribe to the podcast, download previous shows, listen to your heart's content. Very little reading required. Again, that's tespodcast.com. This has been The Eastern Shore.
I have been and continue to be Brock Winstead. Thank you for listening. We will do it again next week.
Just talk. not last.